from 90.5 WESA. This is The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gaffney.
I believe that we have to be honest with the American people. I think sometimes we can disagree with the facts. There are certain things that we may not fully understand when we come out, but our intention is never to lie to you.
The growing antagonism between the Trump administration and the media. How does it affect reporters doing their jobs and how their work is perceived? Plus, women's marches across the country, including in Pittsburgh.
I just want, you know, my daughter to grow up in a world where she doesn't have to feel like she has to fight for everything again and again.
But what are the next steps? Also, President Trump signed executive orders this week that should be good news to the pipeline and oil and gas industries. How will that affect Pennsylvania? We'll discuss all that on our weekly news roundup. The Confluence follows this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, an estimated 2-3 million people took part in women's marches across the country, including here in Pittsburgh Saturday. But what are the next steps? And President Trump signs executive orders to begin the process for approving the Keystone XL pipeline and to manufacture those pipes in the U.S. But first, the tense relationship between candidate Donald Trump and the media seems to have deteriorated in the first week of his presidency, with questions over facts, alternative facts, even honesty. How will this affect journalists doing their jobs? Joining us in studio, Hallie Stockton, managing editor for Public Source, an investigative news service. Welcome, Hallie.
Hi, how are you today?
I am well, thank you. And Mike Wershagen, investigative reporter for the Caucus, still a new weekly print-only newspaper, which reports on state government and politics. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. And if you have a comment or question, please tweet us at WESA Confluence. The questions about the veracity of information and news reports started escalating over questions about the size of the crowd at the inauguration. White House spokesman Sean Spicer challenged the numbers reported by the major media outlets. The next day on Meet the Press, counselor to the president, Kellyanne Conway, said Spicer was providing alternative facts. Alexis Mantzoulias is the director of international fact-checking for the Poynt Institute. He spoke with the Confluence's producer, Marcus Charleston, earlier today.
Facts continue to matter, and the panic around alternative facts, around post-truth, around fake news just seems to exaggerate how much they will continue to matter.
All right. Mike, Hallie, I assume that you agree that facts continue to matter. Has there been any panic over this? And if so, if you've noticed it, by whom?
I don't know if there's been panic necessarily, but I think, you know, for journalists, hearing somebody say that is a bit frustrating, because, you know, this is there are a few things that are supposed to be sacrosanct, and one of them is truth. And if you abandon that, I'm not sure where you can go from there. So there's been pushback, certainly, but I don't know about panic necessarily.
Yeah, that hasn't been my experience. Definitely a lot of raised eyebrows, a little bit of, you know, conversation among journalists trying to figure out what's the best way to make it so that people don't start considering the terminology alternative facts as something they should be using in their everyday language. It kind of makes you feel like you're in a different country, regardless of your politics. There, it is true. Facts than true should be there should be one answer. Yes. Yeah.
So, maybe it's better to say it made people alternative happy.
Yeah, on the wall in our newsroom, there's a New Yorker cartoon featuring a game show. It's titled Facts Don't Matter. So we might laugh at that cartoon. So given the climate, given some of the comments we've been hearing during the campaign and even in the past week, do facts matter just as much as they ever did, the same, or because of this, do they matter even more? Hallie?
I would hope for all news organizations that facts have always mattered just as much as they do now. I think that possibly proving how we're coming to, you know, display those facts or present those facts, proving that to the American public may be something that the media needs to take more seriously. You saw with the inauguration crowd, there were visuals, that side-by-side visuals, you know, more along those lines of, like, how can you dispute this, even though they still were disputed. But I think, you know, finding multiple sources to back up those facts and sharing that, being very transparent with the public about where we're finding the facts.
I think that's a really, really good point. A couple of years ago, there was a big debate over whether, you know, the Washington Press Corps was overusing anonymous sources because some of these were purely political attacks, and, you know, do you really need to give somebody cover for that? And now I think it's the debate shifting a little further down the road towards what Hallie was talking about, that, you know, we should show our work.
Yeah. Transparency, accuracy, fairness, that should lead to trust between the media and the citizenry. Again, here is Alexis Mansalaris of Poynter on that trust factor.
The media should adapt to a context of lower trust overall. The most obvious step we could take as journalists seems to me greater transparency and showing more evidence of where you've taken the facts and why those facts should be trusted.
So have either of you, Hallie as a reporter and managing editor, and you as an investigative reporter, have you, you know, developed concerns about, does the public trust our work? Has the trust diminished at all? Will it diminish if we keep hearing these challenges to the press and their factual reporting?
Yeah, it is a concern. But it's also a reality. We have to operate in a time when trust in the media, as well as, you know, many other institutions, is at a very low ebb, and it does us and our readers no good, and listeners no good, to pretend otherwise. I mean, we have to acknowledge this, and we have to work to disprove it as much as we can. The alternative is to, you know, either just completely blow it off and increase that disconnect, or to not be as rigorous as we could be and give them a reason not to trust us, which is far, far worse.
Hallie, have you experienced that? Has that sort of filtered down to local and regional media? A lot of these comments have been made to the national media, mm-hmm. including television and a couple the major newspapers, the Times and the Washington Post. Do you think any of that concern about trust is filtered down to local and regional media?
Absolutely, I do. I think that, you know, the mainstream media is what, you know, is reaching the largest amount of people at this point. And so in a lot of communities, they're only kind of, even though it's virtual interaction with a journalist, is through the medium that's being it's being questioned the most. So when they do talk to local or regional media, they have that same question. We're all in the same club, you know, according to them and their perception. And in a lot of cases that, you know, the mainstream media did fail in kind of showing, you know, different cross sections of people and their opinions. And so it is being extrapolated to local and regional media. We have people who, you know, sometimes don't even want to talk to us because they just figure, oh, you're just part of the liberal media. And we've had a lot of conversations, internal conversations, about how can we show that we care about everyone and want to get those opinions objectively exposed in our outlet.
Yeah. Is that a challenge to the both of you to say, hold it, if people won't talk to us, we want to find out. We want to get your take on this. We want to get facts from you, or what you consider to be the facts. We want to be fair to all sides, but are you running into that where people maybe don't even want to talk to you because they think you might spin it a different way?
Sure. You know, when I worked for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, it was a newspaper that was owned by Richard Mellon Scaife, right, who had, you know, was heavily involved in conservative causes around the country. And so there were plenty of times when I talked to somebody and they would assume that, you know, I'm here to to push a certain point of view. The way around that is to remind people that you're not the media. You're somebody who's really interested in their story, and you want to make sure it gets told. That's our job. And if you just stick to that, I think it goes a long way towards letting that one individual know. I mean, trust overall is in a bad spot, but on a one-on-one basis, it becomes a lot easier to show that you're just another human being.
And the really unfortunate thing about that is when that doesn't work, when they don't kind of take that leap of faith in you as a person, is our news media just gets more and more sectioned off. They become echo chambers. They only hear from the same people. So all of, one chain of thought will go to a certain organization, right, and another to, to whatever else. And it will erode journalism in general if that's the trend that continues.
Yeah, and that can happen out of laziness. Oh, we'll just go to this voice because we know we can get him or her. They're easily accessible. But that is our goal, to get as many voices and points of view as possible. So,
yeah, and not just as many as possible, but a representative cross-section. You don't want to leave a piece of the story untold, because then whoever is affected by it is going to assume that you don't know what you're doing. And that's going to – that goes back to that trust issue.
Right. I want to get to a point where, okay, you've had these relationships between media and administration, whether it's at the federal level or at another governmental level. But since we're focusing today on the relationship of media in the Trump presidency, there's this question. Well, we want to put our president, our elected official in the best light, and so we use this information to do it, whereas the media will use information, all the information, which does not necessarily put that person in the best light, but it is a more broad picture. But it's the name-calling that has really gotten to me. But the name-calling's not new. If we remember, maybe you two don't, Spiro Agnew and his famous quote, "Nattering nabobs of negativism," referring to the media. And, of course, he didn't write that. Who wrote that? The Nixon speechwriter, William Safire, actually wrote that phrase. But the name-calling has been there, and we're seeing name-calling from some of the Trump advisors now. I mean, isn't that going beyond, though, the name-calling of the media, calling them out?
Well, you can't control what somebody's going to say about you. You do have a say, though, in whether it's true or not. And I think in this environment, we're just going to have to get a bit of a thicker skin. Mm-hmm. And yeah, not necessarily just take it. No. I don't mean sit back and let it go unchallenged. But don't respond in kind. That's not what we do.
Right.
That's not our role. That's not our job. It's not what people need us to do.
We're talking about the role of journalists covering the Trump administration, and also in an era of facts, alternative facts, half-truths, dishonest journalism, as was called by President Trump. And we're talking with Hallie Stockton. She's managing editor for Public Source, and Mike Wershak, an investigative reporter for the Caucus. This is the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Donald Trump's chief strategist, Stephen Bonner, called it, when he was talking about the media, the opposition party to the current administration. Now, to be fair, the Columbia Journalism Review noted today that in a 2009 New York Times story, President Obama's communications director, Anita Dunn, said of Fox News, "We're going to treat them the way we would treat an opponent." So there's not a lot of difference there. But opponent, adversarial, or is it just the duty of journalists to question the authority, the role of those in power? Allie?
It absolutely is. We're here to hold officials accountable, to ensure that the systems that are put in place are protecting citizens. I agree with Mike that, the name calling isn't great, but it's one of those things that we have to grow a thicker skin and thrive on it. I mean, journalists have been called names by more than just the president. And that trickles down all the way to local and regional media, too. And so I think it's one of those times where you just you take it and then you thrive on it and do good journalism. As far as being called the opposition party, the only thing that I really kind of don't enjoy about that is being classified as a party, because people connect that to political parties, and just I think naturally, and I think that journalism should remain free of that kind of classification.
Yeah, it also gives us, I think, way too much credit for our organizational skills. We're not a party. We are a pretty disparate collection of people who can't do anything else for a living, and so here we are. Opposition is part of the job, but it certainly is not it's not a party.
All right. So the next 4 years, do you think they'll be extra challenging to the media? Let's hear one more time from Alexis Mantzoularis of Pointer.
Journalists around the world are in tougher situations than American journalists. There are very brave reporters doing their work in authoritarian regimes. So I don't feel too sorry for the American media. The job needs to be done well, and I'm sure it will be done well.
All right, so Alexis sort of puts it all into perspective there, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So my question is, so what challenges do you think this presents? Is just you're going to work harder, you're going to double-check, triple-check, whatever, to make sure that there are no slip-ups. There's no chance for see, you are not being fair. You are wrong.
It's not just that. I mean, yes, we certainly have to do that. We have a duty to get the information correct or to provide the correct information. But it's also going to have to be when people do jump on us for getting something wrong, because we do get things wrong. It's going to happen. When that happens, we have a duty to correct it immediately. As quickly as we can, as soon as we can verify what the actual information is, we run a correction, which is a great way to evaluate whether you should trust a media site or a media outlet. See if they run corrections. Because if they don't, it's probably not because they never make a mistake.
I have one last question. It has to do with fact-checking. A lot of things have gotten fact-checked. And I was talking to a listener the day before the inauguration. I said, well, President-elect Trump's recent speeches during the campaign, when he was candidate Trump, fact-checked during the debates and all that. Of course, Hillary Clinton was fact-checked. I said President Obama's farewell address and his farewell news conference were fact-checked. And he said, well, who's checking the fact-checkers? What can you do there when even the facts are challenged? We have 1 minute. Hallie?
I think, again, that's just adding more people on the chain, making sure that all of them are checking their bias at the door, and or maybe making sure that they have just differing, they're coming from different places, and independent of the original person who has created that fact or written it.
Yeah, news consumers need to step up to the plate a bit, too. You can't judge whether something is true based on whether it makes you comfortable or not, and I think we really need to recommit ourselves to being uncomfortable once in a while and taking in information that we don't necessarily want to be true but are going to have to deal with anyway.
Mike Warshagen is an investigative reporter for The Caucus. Hallie Stockton is the managing editor for Public Source. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
A one-time major event or the first step towards something else? What follows the women's marches? That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Crowd estimates, as we've seen, can be a point of contention. Let's just say there were a lot of people in cities across the country, including Washington and Pittsburgh, involved in the women's marches the day after Donald Trump's inauguration as president. Joining us now to talk about what was accomplished, what could be next, Virginia Alvino Young, WESA reporter. Welcome, Virginia.
Hi, Kevin.
And Megan Harris, digital editor and reporter for WESA. Welcome, Megan.
Hey, Kevin.
If you have a comment or question, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence.
In the 60s, I marched and I prayed and I worked and I dealt with prejudice on the job. And I'm just determined that my daughter and my granddaughter are not going to go through what I went through.
That was Rosemary McLaughlin at the Downtown Pittsburgh March, who was with her daughter and granddaughter. To both of you, did you get the sense of concern, fear of not just improving women's rights, but slippage? Virginia?
Yes. Traditionally, issues that are considered to be women's rights, maybe pay equity, sexual abuse, reproductive rights, those are on the table for a lot of women. But I think for a lot of women as well, as you can tell just by the signs that are being held, it goes a lot further beyond that. People, women as people, you know, and their allies as well, their companions, their families, their partners are saying, we're also very concerned about the politics in general. The
cabinet
appointee is a big one, right? Healthcare, a big one. Education, a big one as well.
Okay. Megan, did you get any sense of that, that there was concern about issues that are specific really to women or the broader advances, as some would say, might be pulled back?
Well, I think women, you know, kind of just... It's not even a gender issue for a lot of women who are going out there, especially younger women who haven't had to have those incremental fights, mm-hmm. You know, that we hear about that more historically, like through the 60s and 70s and 80s, those bigger ones, some involving Supreme Court decisions. It's newer to that generation. So they're coming out, they're supporting, but they're also hearing as part of that some of this intersectional debate, this intergenerational idea that, you know, this isn't the first time this happened. You know, you just watched it with the candidate that you supported, maybe Hillary Clinton, but it's happened before, and it's time for you to learn your history and to move forward from there.
Okay. Now, you two were in different places on Saturday. Megan, you were in Washington, D.C., and Virginia, you were here in Pittsburgh. Megan, as you covered the National Women's March, question, how diverse was the crowd? And you can define diversity however you want to.
I would say that it was probably, I personally witnessed more white people, white women, than I did anything else. The divide that I saw most acutely, though, was in, like I said, that intergenerational gap. There were children, there were young women, there were middle-aged women, there were women in wheelchairs. And again, their partners were beside them yelling, you know, variations on chants, her body, her choice, things like that. So the support was totally different. And especially for those older women that I spoke to, seeing, you know, their younger sisters, their granddaughters, their daughters. I saw one great-granddaughter. Having them beside them for the same fight that they've been having, you know, in their minds and their worlds for the last 30, 40, 50 years meant a lot, but also made them feel, you know, like, have we really made that much progress? You know, my granddaughter shouldn't have to walk beside me for this fight again.
Yeah, we heard that in that comment earlier at the beginning of our conversation, the grandmother who walked with her daughter and her granddaughter. Virginia, what did you see in terms of diversity here in Pittsburgh?
Well, I was at the march that was titled Our Feminism Must Be Intersectional March
and
Rally.
That was in East Liberty?
That was in East Liberty. It started at Penn Plaza, and it marched on down the street to the Summit Against Racism. So that was basically born of issues with what was supposed to be Pittsburgh's sister march in solidarity with the March on Washington and the hundreds of marches happening across the country. Concerns there that leadership wasn't inclusive enough, wasn't diverse enough. So the event that I attended was created entirely by Black femmes who elevated their own issues and the issues of other marginalized groups. So they were at the center. They made space for themselves. It was not an anti-Trump event so much as a celebration of their existence, making space for themselves and other marginalized groups. But the group of hundreds of people, a very large group, was majority white, I would say. Oh. But following behind the leadership that had intentionally centered their issues.
Okay. You did a story on that for WESA mm-hmm. leading up to the Trump inauguration. What did you discover in your reporting on that? maybe split is too harsh of a word.
Right. Split implies two sides, right? But there's two distinct sides to the issue, and it's really not. I think what was maybe the most important quote from that story was from the director of the Women's Institute at Chatham University, who said, you know, solidarity, the idea of solidarity, is largely a fiction. With feminism, just as any other group, there have been tensions historically along racial lines and along other lines. So it was not a black and white issue. It was, are we recognizing that feminism has historically been a white movement?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, in Washington, just again, observationally, there were still huge populations of Latina women, of black women, of, you know, varying opinions, varying ideals of what they were trying there to fight for. A lot of people brought their children just to see what this would be. A lot of children had more thought out ideas of what they were fighting for than some of the adults. I talked to some women who just said they wanted to see what it would look like. And, you know, to be in that overwhelming environment with seven, depending on the number you see, 500,000, 750,000, 1 million people packed into a fairly confined space was an overwhelming message, no matter which message you choose to promote.
We're talking about the women's marches, not just the National March in Washington, D.C., but two different events here in Pittsburgh and, of course, marches around the country and what the next steps are. We're talking with WESA reporter Virginia Alvino Young and Megan Harris, WESA digital editor and reporter who covered those marches. This is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Unity and diversity. Are they at sort of at a conflict? Can they coexist? Did they coexist in events when in Washington and in Pittsburgh?
A lot of those terms, very, very problematic, right? A lot of women here in Pittsburgh, especially when things were sort of unfolding with the organization of the Sisters March here, saying, we just need to be women first. And that idea can be extremely problematic because not everybody identifies as a woman or along traditional gendered lines. Again, the movement has had racial tensions in the past. Do we fight for women's rights or do we fight for the abolition of slavery? So this idea that we all need to be one can be very easily seen as minimizing the unique experiences of people with other identities. So I think going forward, it is going to require some form of coalition, just as any social movement does. But what issues do we center? Who leads the charge on those issues? That's the question, and going to really determine how effective and how inclusive or divided the movement here in Pittsburgh or across the country is going to be.
Did you get that women first message, Megan? And was there an implied, unspoken word, white, in front of?
I think that depends on who you ask and from what perspective you're coming at. I think there is, for a lot of white women who maybe don't have that experience of being an other class in the same way that, you know, a black woman in Pittsburgh might versus a white woman in Massachusetts. You know, if the two met in D.C., they're coming from completely different perspectives. They're coming for different reasons, and all of those should be valid and should be considered. I think the organizers in Pittsburgh, you know, they weren't dealing with a unique set of challenges. Sister marches across the country face some of these issues, trying to figure out what to promote and what not. The Women's March on Washington itself faced these same issues to begin with on arguably a much larger platform from its original inception, from, you know, one Facebook post from a woman in Hawaii to the eventual group of women, very diverse, very different perspectives, who ended up planning the event that I attended last week.
I mean, Pittsburgh, honestly, had a very similar trajectory, right, in terms of these issues being brought up by women of color and other groups. Is this an inclusive leadership? And the committee was reformed. Their mission statement was realigned with more of these inclusive statements. The speakers at the event represented a lot more diverse groups. So it did have that adaptation and that evolution as
A lot of similar themes developed from the Washington March and played out in Pittsburgh as well.
Yeah, I think we have a habit, probably a bad habit, of putting people into categories, into boxes, because it's convenient, it's easier that way. We talk about the black community, the Latino vote, trying to break through those boxes, those walls, whatever, aren't we? Or at least the reporters need to see that things don't fit neatly into boxes.
And people are not standing for those boxes. I mean, I asked one of the Black Femme organizers about what I was hearing on the other side, and that idea was quickly rejected, that there were these distinct, clear sides to some debate.
Megan, I was looking at your web post on WESA, the slideshow that you published, a couple dozen photos from Washington. And check it out at WESA.fm if you haven't. I was looking at the signs in particular. I was looking at the people, but I started looking at the signs. And I was seeing things like, oh, signs with some issues on them. Equal pay, Black Lives Matter, some statements or demands, resist, truth matters, respect us, love Trump's hate. And to the very simple, I'm upset.
Yeah, there was a smattering of all kinds, a lot of homemade, a lot of printed. There were a lot of artists that stepped up in the weeks prior to the marches, again, both local and nationwide, that said, you know, I just want to create something that is emblematic of this fight, of this protest, of this statement, of this moment, and made their designs available for all manner of people to print out, to do whatever they like. They opened their copyright. So there was a lot of the same type of sign, but a lot of celebration of just whatever they had at hand.
Mm-hmm. What sort of signs did you see?
So again, the intersectional, our feminism right. must be intersectional event, specifically not anti-Trump was their messaging. Although there were still some, you know, right. dump Trump signs and right. things of the matter. A lot of, you know, in Pittsburgh, we build bridges and not walls. More intentional messaging regarding intersectionality and race. You know, white people holding signs saying white silence equals violence. Everything from disability rights or human rights from a lot of various groups. But their lead banner by the organizers that led the march down the street was a solidarity banner.
And of course, one of the biggest signs that, you know, didn't necessarily have any writing on it was the hats that a lot of women wore to the rallies.
The pink hats.
Right. Can we say that? On
well,
the
okay. Well,
the hats.
The pink hats. You can
yeah,
just look
yeah,
for
the pink it. Hats that a lot of women wore. You know, those, they didn't have any messaging on them, but they had a very clear message. When you look out into the crowd and see that, you know, at least a level third of it is a wave of pink.
Speaking of message. Was there hope at either event that you covered, that you two covered, that the message was heard and any hope that it'll be acted upon? Or was it just important to spell out the message? Was there any sense that, okay, they're going to hear this message, whoever it was directed toward?
So many problematic ideas. Who is the they? What is the message? Who did you?
Well, it's different because right, you so, said the event you attended wasn't necessarily an anti-Trump.
But even within these larger groups, it's a diverse group of people, even within maybe these more at first homogenous looking groups, but with a very broad spectrum of issues that they do have. But what we've sort of learned in talking to longtime organizers, sociology professors, and the like, of why these large-scale public demonstrations are important is it may be important to get that influx of new people that are new to activism engaged, to make them feel like they're not alone and to make them feel like they can make a difference. Also to sort of have that large-scale expression of discontent with the status quo. So it may be less about somebody heard that I am against restricting abortion access, as opposed to what does this mean for the movement? What does this mean for the energy of any given individual?
Yeah, certainly it's a moment to, you know, acknowledge your unhappiness with the situation and your desire to be seen, whatever that might mean for you. So many people I talked to said it was also, you know, something of a celebration and a moment to acknowledge mm-hmm. that, you know, this is just a jumping off point. This is the part where we all come together, we all say what we feel, we have our truth, and then we, you know, on Saturday you march, on Monday you write your legislator.
Okay, well, that leads to my final question. We have just about a minute left. Is what is next? If anything, was it a massive one-time event or the first step towards something? And what will you two as reporters be interested in following up on?
One of the organizers, not for these particular events, but, you know, someone who's been in the community for a long time said to me this morning that, you know, this is about the elections now, you know, and it's not 2020, it's not 2018, it's 2017. It's this year, it's what's going into place right now, it's who's filing to run for elected office, it's who's stepping up to support those people and making sure that the message that they want out there, you know, in these years to come is solidified right now.
Virginia?
And I've been hearing something a little bit different from some of the organizers that I've been working with, the frustration from the people who have been doing the work all along with these new people who come in are only interested in maybe doing these large-scale events. And yes, writing your legislators is important, but worried that these people aren't going to take what they see as the most important step, which is plugging into established organizations locally, building coalitions, taking the education responsibility upon themselves and others to understand the issues a little bit better. And to really dig in for the long term. So that's the question that we'll be looking at going forward.
Virginia Alvino-Young is a reporter for 90.5 WESA. Megan Harris, reporter and digital editor for WESA. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kev.
Coming up, pipeline industry leaders gather in Pittsburgh as President Trump signs executive orders to move forward with the Keystone XL pipeline. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together at 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A few hundred pipeline industry executives gathered in Pittsburgh Wednesday and Thursday for a national conference, coincidentally a day after President Trump signed executive orders, basically reviving the Keystone XL and the Dakota Access Pipelines. Let's talk about what this could mean for Pennsylvania with Marie Cusick, reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania, who joins us by phone from Harrisburg. Welcome, Marie.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And in studio, Reed Frazier, reporter for the Allegheny Front. Welcome back to the show, Reed.
Hi, Kevin.
You both covered the pipeline industry conference held in Pittsburgh Wednesday and Thursday. A little background, the Keystone XL pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, proposed to go from where to where, is it going through, that kind of thing. Let's start with you, Marie.
Well, those are two big national pipelines, and neither of them are in Pennsylvania, so the Keystone XL is a project of TransCanada to move Canadian oil sands from Canada down to Nebraska. And the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline is another project to move oil from North Dakota to Illinois. That was the big one that was protested by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. So those are kind of two really big national symbols of the pipeline fights, but neither of them are in Pennsylvania.
But I think importantly, both were the subject of big protests and kind of a focal point for folks who are opposed to fossil fuel development for variety of reasons, but global warming being one of them.
So it does have an impact here in Pennsylvania, not directly those pipelines, obviously. Does President Trump's message in signing those executive orders, could it be farther reaching than just those two pipelines? Does it signal anything?
Well, I think the signal is pretty clear for, you know, it's well in keeping with Trump's philosophy about all this that he articulated during the campaigns, that he wants to see, fossil fuels being extracted and developed in the United States. Pipelines are, I guess you could have a oil and gas system without pipelines, but they make it a lot easier. He is clearly making a signal that this is who he is. This is where he wants to see the country going.
Marie, do you see any signal in the president's orders beyond those two particular pipelines?
Yeah, he's been a very big cheerleader of the oil and gas industry. So I think this is clearly right out of the gate. This is what he wanted to show people, that he is committed to supporting the oil and gas industry. I think at the conference in Pittsburgh this week, what I heard was definitely optimism. People in the oil and gas industry are happy to have a cheerleader at the federal level, but it's tempered with the fact that states do have a lot of control over what happens, and they have a lot of ways that they can stymie projects. In fact, you know, speaking to a guy yesterday who He supplies contracting equipment, Caterpillar equipment, that was to be used on the Mariner pipeline, which is a project to move natural gas liquids from western Pennsylvania to a terminal near Philadelphia. And that has been held up because it has not received the necessary state-level permits. Another pipeline called the Constitution is to move natural gas out of northeastern Pennsylvania up into New England. That has been blocked by New York State, which has not issued necessary permits for that. So I think a lot of the regulation for the oil and gas industry is actually at the state level. So folks are happy to see Trump in the White House, happy to have a federal cheerleader, hope things might change for them. But still there's the reality of, you know, if the state doesn't issue your permit, you don't have your permit, you can't move forward.
Well, let's hear from one of those CEOs that Marie alluded to. This is Alan Armstrong. He's the CEO of the pipeline company Williams. He told his colleagues not to get too complacent.
We've got an administration that's supportive of our business today. But I will tell you, that is not changing the opposition that we have at a local level. And we're going to continue to see that. And I would tell you, it may even enhance.
So, Reed, guarded optimism? Marie used the word optimism. Would you say guarded or is it optimistic?
Yeah, I mean, I think Marie's absolutely right. I mean, I don't think, you know, if they're, let's just say that a lot of these folks are glad that that Trump got elected because of all the reasons we've talked about, his support for oil and gas. And, you know, the funny thing about the Constitution pipeline that Marie just mentioned, I just want to go back to that.
Right.
That's a federally regulated pipeline. But because it goes through different states might have a, you know, a legal vantage point from which to sort of block these pipelines or slow them down. So even when it's a federal pipeline and, you know, let's just say the federal government's all 100% behind it, these states can get in the way of completing them. And also, I think importantly, in the case of Standing Rock and Keystone XL, a lot of the, you know, protest can have a huge impact on what politicians do. And the folks at this pipeline conference that me and Marie were at this week, I mean, I think they're acutely aware of that, probably more than, you know, most of us think they would be. But they're really paying attention to this. I had a guy tell me, a contractor who who bids on these big pipelines, and he says, you know, we're sort of planning for more resistance to these pipelines as you know, we're building out more pipelines even in this region.
So that resistance can come whether it's at federal or state. There are federal and state hurdles to overcome.
Yeah, or just people setting up tents on a pipeline route and saying don't dig here.
Okay. I want to get to a couple more things that have happened. It's been a busy week surrounding whether it's the oil and gas industry. I want to get a couple of things to you. Marie, you reported on drilling royalties. The State Senate committee unanimously approved a pair of bills aimed at providing more protections for people who receive royalty money from oil and gas drilling. Briefly, what was that about? And it wasn't just the same, basically same piece of legislation of a couple years ago?
Yeah, this is about basically there have been years of complaints from some landowners who are supposed to be receiving royalties from gas drilling on their land. And they've been complaining that some gas companies, not all of them, but a few, have been really withholding money from them and not paying what they feel like is, in some cases, just fraudulently withholding money, not paying them for the gas. So this has just become a huge and kind of growing issue, particularly in the northern tier of Pennsylvania. A lot of complaints have been directed at Chesapeake Energy because that's where a lot of their holdings are, and they've been accused of fraud repeatedly in a number of lawsuits. So over the years, this has just kind of snowballed, and a lot of people have been turning to the legislature and saying, hey, you need to change the royalties law and make sure people are being paid properly. Just very little has been done, though. As I mentioned in the story, these two bills, one would allow people to have more ability to sort of audit gas company statements to see what they're saying they're producing, what they're supposed to be paying. The other would prohibit drillers from retaliating against people who question their payments, because some people feel like if they speak out and say, hey, you're not paying me, then, you know, the company might shut off the well or something. But interestingly, these two bills are not very controversial, but they've basically gone nowhere. The controversial legislation is that royalty advocates want is that they want the legislature to say, hey, you need to set a minimum royalty and make sure that people are paid a minimum. Right now, the statutory minimum is 12.5%. They want that law clarified. They just want to make sure they get paid. But that's been very controversial, and that's gone nowhere. So, you know, the Republican lawmaker sponsoring these two bills, he told me that, you know, this has just been held up because everyone wants to package this all together. And but it's really a growing issue. I talked to some royalty advocates just this week. They say people in Western Pennsylvania have also been complaining about some other companies. They feel like, you know, a couple companies have sort of the bad apples, and now the rest of the industry is kind of getting on board with this.
All right. And, Reid, I want to ask you quickly about a story that you cover. A judge, environmental law judge, ordered a halt to mining underneath the Ryerson Station State Park in Greene County. So this was actually, CONSOL was actually received a permit from the DEP to do this in December. So where do we stand now on this longwall mining issue?
Yeah, so what the judge ordered was the actual issue was whether or not they could mine under two streams inside a park. And the argument from the environmental groups, the Sierra Club and the Center for Coalfield Justice, was that when they did this longwall mining, it's predicted that you would cause subsidence to the stream. And right. When you do that, you can lose the stream flow. It can flow through the cracks. To fix it, to fix the stream, the company would pour cement, inject cement or grout into the cracks, or simply rebuild the stream. Just this week, an environmental hearing board judge in Pittsburgh ruled that they cannot mine under this particular stream or come within 100 feet of it. So that's where it stands. CONSOL said it'll vigorously appeal.
And where would that appeal go to quickly?
Not quite positive. One of the appellate courts.
One of the appellate courts. In
yeah.
The state. All right. Very good. Reid Frazier is a reporter for the Allegheny Front. Marie Cusick is a reporter with State Impact Pennsylvania. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Finally, 2 weeks ago on this program, we reported that the state prison in Pittsburgh was on a list for possible closure. Yesterday, the word came down from the Wolf administration that the State Corrections Department is shutting down SCI Pittsburgh, the 134-year-old state prison. WESA's Margaret J. Krause has been following this story. Margaret, SCI Pittsburgh, one of five prisons under consideration for shutdown. Why was it chosen?
Well, it seems like a pretty fluid situation. It wasn't until 2 weeks ago that the Department of Corrections began to consider SCI Pittsburgh for closure because it offered specialized mental health services, as well as a veterans unit, an oncology unit. But overall, among the five prisons that were considered for closure, this area has the lowest unemployment rate. And also, this site is 24 acres on the riverfront, so its potential for redevelopment seemed particularly strong.
So they looked at the unemployment because those jobs, guards, others who are workers there, although they were being offered or will be offered jobs elsewhere in the system, right?
Yes, they will have the opportunity to take a job somewhere else in the state system within a 90-mile radius, most likely.
So 2005, SCI Pittsburgh was shut down for 2 years, but it was mothballed. That's not happening this time around.
No. Correction Secretary John Wetzel said yesterday, mothballing is not an option for SCI Pittsburgh. Some of the prisons, they thought, oh, maybe the federal government will put federal inmates here and that's how these communities will continue to make money. That is not the case with SCI Pittsburgh. It is going to be somehow added back to the tax rolls, hopefully, and developed.
Do we have any idea yet or when we might have an idea of who will be in charge of development or overseeing it? Will it be the state? Would it be Pittsburgh, Allegheny County? Do we know anything yet?
That seems unclear. Corrections Secretary Wetzel said yesterday, you know, he wasn't too clear on how the process would go, but it will happen, they said, sometime in the near future. But how and when and who is unclear as of yet.
Margaret J. Krause is WESA's Keystone Crossroads reporter. Thanks so much, Margaret.
Thanks for having me.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence, Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good week of good news.